This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Fabulous fundraisers every year, and it's a just great opportunity to have some of the best desserts that are made here in Montrose and throughout the city. Also, we have an interview talking about the play Bent, which is happening at the Holocaust Museum this Saturday and Sunday, 7:30 Saturday and 6 p.m. Sunday. And, of course, the Holocaust Museum is located at 5401 Caroline. For more information on Bent, it's 713-522-2204. So all that's coming up, plus our segments from This Way Out, which includes news wrap, and also the audio file, which JD contributes to every week. So all that's coming up on Queer Voices, which includes Queer Music Heritage this week. But before that, we go to the BBC News in London.
BBC News with Zoe Diamond. The head of the International Commission overseeing the disarmament of paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland says he believes the militant Irish Republican organisation, the IRA, has given up all its weapons. John de Chastelin, a retired Canadian general, said a very large quantity of arms, including mortars, machine guns, flamethrowers, ammunition and explosives, had been rendered permanently inaccessible or unusable. He said anyone who remained sceptical about the process would have to take him on trust. The leader of the main Protestant party in Northern Ireland, Ian Paisley, rejected the report, saying it gave no inventory of the weapons involved or details of their destruction. The decommissioning was witnessed by two churchmen, one Roman Catholic, the other the Protestant clergyman, the Reverend Harold Good.
We saw weapons being put out of use. We saw explosives being put out of use, and we saw ammunition being put out of use in huge quantities. And of that, there's no doubt. Our eyes have been, as it were, the lens through which we would want the community to be able to understand that what they have asked for and rightly demanded, has now taken place.
The IRA announced in July that it was ending its long campaign of violence in pursuit of a united Ireland. The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, spoke of his hope that the peace process in Northern Ireland could now be fulfilled. The Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has narrowly won a vote by members of his governing Likud party, avoiding attempts by his political rivals to bring forward the date of a leadership election. Matthew Price was at the count in Tel Aviv.
Many in Israel will be asking how Ariel Sharon does it. Yet again, the great survivor has won, but only just. His party, the Likud, had to vote on whether to hold an early leadership election. It was, in effect, a vote of confidence on Mr. Sharon. His critics, led by the former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, wanted to oust their leader. They said that his decision to leave the Gaza Strip was ill-conceived and damaging to Israel. Shortly after the vote was announced, Ariel Sharon called on the party to unite behind him. Benjamin Netanyahu said he did accept the vote, but he also said he would one day challenge Mr. Sharon again.
A military panel in the United States has found the American soldier, Private Lindy England, guilty of abusing prisoners at the Abu Ghraib jail near Baghdad. From Washington, our correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
The publication of graphic photos of Lindy England smiling and posing beside naked and humiliated Iraqi prisoners began this whole ugly chapter that's damaged America's image all over the world. Lindy England has finally been found guilty on four counts of maltreating detainees, one count of conspiracy, and one count of committing an indecent act. It took a panel of five military officers just 2 hours to reach their verdict. Lindy England's original guilty plea was rejected at a military tribunal earlier this year. The plea conflicted with evidence given by her former boyfriend, Specialist Charles Grainer, who claimed the photographs had been taken for military training purposes.
You're listening to the news from the BBC. The trial is underway in Peru of one of South America's most notorious rebels, the Shining Path leader, Abimael Guzman. It is the second attempt to grant him a civilian trial after a military court that jailed him for life in 1992 was ruled to have been unconstitutional. A retrial last year collapsed after two of the three judges stood down. Guzman and a number of other leading members of the Shining Path guerrilla movement face charges of terrorism and murder, allegedly committed during the 1980s and 1990s. A senior United Nations official has strongly criticized the Sudanese government's efforts to bring peace to the western region of Darfur. Juan Mendez, an advisor on the prevention of genocide who has just returned from the region, said Khartoum government was continuing to allow war criminals to go unpunished.
I think it's easy to turn militias and paramilitary groups on, but it's a lot harder to turn them off. So I'm not minimizing the difficulties. At the same time, difficulties or no, we don't see a serious good faith effort on the part of the government to disarm.
President Bush has said that the experience of Hurricanes Rita and Katrina shows that America needs to open new oil refineries in new locations. He urged the U.S. Congress to relax regulations on building refineries, including provision on air quality control. Environmental activists accuse the White House of using the storms to pursue its political agenda. And that's the latest BBC News.
This Way Out is heard every week.
And that is the BBC News. Welcome to Queer Voices. This is Jack Walensky. And
J.D.
along
Doyle.
With me is...
J.D. Doyle.
And?
And?
And? Who are you?
And? Deborah Bell.
Okay.
And Glenn is off, I don't know, in space or something.
He is somewhere, yes. And as usual, when Glenn's not here, it doesn't run quite as smoothly as when he is here. This evening, besides talking about the Decadent Dessert fundraiser that's coming up this weekend, we're also going to be doing an interview. Actually, J.D. did an interview about the play Bent.
Yes, with Steve Bullitt, the lead actor in the play. And I interviewed him a couple weeks ago, and he talks about the role and the show. And we'll get to that a little later.
And the second hour
is Queer Music Heritage, where I was very pleased to interview one of the women who, one of the main activists of women's music in the 80s and 90s. She founded Hot Wire magazine, was involved with a couple other magazines, very deep in the thick of it, not as an artist, but as a mover and shaker to get the music out there. And in the second half of Queer Music Heritage, I interviewed Frank, one of our political humorous folk singers, and that was a lot of fun too.
And that's Frank with a PH.
PHRANC.
And we just, on the note of music, is the Women's Music Festival was postponed due to our threat of a hurricane. So you can check their website if you want to find out when the festival will be rescheduled.
And I'm anxious to find out.
I know you really want to know, but hopefully we'll be able to have them on before the actual event. So with us tonight are Sol Lara and Lynn Swarsenberg. Now, last time I interviewed Lynn, she was here as a runner, but apparently she likes to eat desserts, too, because she's here to talk about decadent desserts.
That's right. You run so you can eat dessert.
It's a slogan. It's a motto. It's a mantra. It's a theme to live by. So, Lynn, exactly what is decadent dessert?
It's a fundraising event for sisters, and it features desserts and appetizers by local restaurants and caterers. This is the fifth year of the event, and we usually have entertainment, and this year, as in years past, it will be held at Meteor.
Okay, and what type of entertainment are you having this year?
This year we're doing something a little bit different.
Or maybe a whole lot different.
A whole lot different. We will have music for dancing in the early part of the event, but kind of in the middle of the event we're going to have Montrose Softball League's Jocks in Dresses. We'll have a few of those guys coming to do a repeat performance from their event earlier this summer.
And this is at Meteor, which is at 2306 Genesee, which is right off of where Fairview turns into 2M. Or Twom, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And it's from 4 to 7 p.m. on Sunday.
On Sunday.
Okay. And I noticed that it's being called Decadent Dessert and More. Is that because of the appetizers?
That's right. We realized that we not only had desserts, we were branching out and having more appetizers. So you have the sweet and the salty. And with Decadent Dessert Extravaganza, you really weren't knowing that there would be something non-sweet. And we were getting feedback from people saying, you know, I don't eat sweets, I'm diabetic, or, you know, I just don't care for sweets. So
what's wrong with them?
Well, you know, we're diverse. We're a diverse community, so we try to be inclusive.
My motto, if it's not chocolate, it's not dessert. And some of the restaurants, why don't you tell me some of who those are, Seoul? Yes, you do have to speak on the microphone.
Well, actually, we've got some wonderful restaurants participating. Some are return restaurants who participated with us last year. Absolutely Divine Catering, Amanda's Bake Shop, Carter Cooley, Eatsies. We have Jim Benton's Catering returning again, Java Java returning, Just Lunch and Catering, the Hyatt Spindletop, of course, Catering, Pepper Tree Veggie Cuisine, and, of course, the Rainbow Lodge.
Now, do you have any idea of exactly what they'll be preparing? Are these their usual menu items, or are they, like, things that they, like a competition to see who can come up with the best dessert of the evening?
For the first time this year, we do have a contest for the best dessert, the best appetizer, and we have fancier names for that. I think it's the most decadent dessert and the most decadent appetizer.
I'll be the judge of that.
Yes, yes. We will have judges. And for decorating, we have most fabulous flair. So we don't know what the restaurants and caterers are bringing. It's always a surprise. And we really ask them to showcase their talents by bringing their most spectacular dessert or appetizer. So it's always something that we look forward to see what's in store for us this year. You may recall last year we had the chocolate fondue, Jim Benton's Catering, and that was a huge success. So we're looking forward to see what they do this year.
Who would have thought that fondue would ever make a comeback? But it did. And then what other items are part of the evening? You're doing a auction. Other than the ticket price, there's...
Right. We're going to have a live auction, and we're also having a silent auction. And some of the auction items are a... round-trip airfare on Southwest Airlines. We have a two-nights stay at a bed and breakfast in South Padre. We have the obligatory Comets jersey framed and signed. We have a Comets basketball. What else?
Other goodies?
Other goodies, yeah. Lots of other goodies that will remain a surprise.
Okay, well, tell me a little bit about the Sisters and why people should be supporting this event.
The Sisters has been around since 1996. It's a nonprofit organization with the mission to create a community of caregivers to help lesbians with long-term illnesses or disabilities have the highest quality of life possible. We have some programs that require funding. One is a supplemental food assistance program where we provide our clients with some cards to Kroger, Luby's, HEB to help support their ability to buy nutritious food. We also have a transportation program which provides taxi vouchers for our clients to get to and from medical appointments. And we're also piloting a program, and we call it our client support group, where through Bearing Support Network, we're providing a weekly support group to our clients, and we're also providing transportation to and from that, because we heard from our clients that they were interested in having a support group, but that transportation would be an issue for them.
And how many clients are you currently serving?
We have close to 30 clients, so we've seen a big increase in the number of clients. And we're also seeing more of our clients not in town, but more close to the Beltway and even outside the Beltway. In years past, we haven't gone beyond the Beltway just to limit our service area, but there's such a need And we are also finding that we have volunteers available outside the Beltway. So as long as we can put together a team of volunteers outside the Beltway, we can service clients outside the Beltway. So having more clients and having clients further away from the medical center significantly impacts the cost of our services.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, everyone I know looks forward to this event every year. Mm-hmm. It's like as soon as they know when it's going to be, it goes on the calendar, and it will be October the 2nd at Meteor from 4 to 7 p.m. And if someone would like to become involved in a sister's, they can volunteer, and how would they go about doing that, and what might they be doing just real quickly?
Okay. They can volunteer either by calling our phone number or looking on our website. And we have, you can email us at contact@assisthers.org. And what we're looking for in volunteers is either someone to be part of a care team. We have various committees that people can get involved with. There's fundraising, outreach, public relations. So even non-client care, we have options for people that aren't interested in direct client care.
So that website is?
www.assisthers.org.
And the phone number? We don't know the phone number. No one uses phone numbers anymore.
It's right here. 713-521-4628.
Well, thanks for being with us. Assisters does also have a in-service once a month, and they have topics with a speaker. I've been to some of them. They're wonderful. Recent topics included coping with dementia and autoimmune diseases, women in depression and nutrition, and those are very valuable. And there's also, like, there's women who may have just had surgery and need short-term care, and then there's other people that have ongoing chronic illnesses, so people that are looking for services, as well as those that would like to volunteer with a really wonderful organization, can get in touch with the sisters. And hope everyone comes out on Sunday and enjoys the desserts.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Gay rights are recognized in a Russian courtroom first, advancing queer rights in union with organized labor, and progressive politics, energetic folk pop, and trashy bi blues mix it up in the audio file. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watt.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 24th, 2005. History was made in a St. Petersburg court this week with Russia's first ruling in favor of a gay person on a gay rights issue. The litigant, identified as Mr. VP, sued the Russian state railways after being denied a job because of his sexual orientation. In 1992, Mr. VP was excluded from military service on the grounds that his homosexuality constituted a perverse psychopathy under the old Soviet classification of mental disorders. A notation to that effect remained in his government records, even though homosexuality is no longer considered a disease in Russia. The Budapest-based Mental Disability Advocacy Center, an international non-governmental organization, represented Mr. VP, arguing that his constitutional rights to education and employment had been violated, and that his homosexuality should never have been considered a disorder in the first place. The court declared the use of military information to restrict human rights unlawful, and reaffirmed that homosexuality is not a mental disorder. Nikolai Alexeyev, head of the organization GayRussia.ru, who is himself involved in an illegal dismissal suit against Lomonosov Moscow State University, called the ruling a huge breakthrough in Russia for LGBT rights. However, it remains to be seen how far the landmark ruling will carry, since precedent is not recognized in the Russian legal system. Still, activists like Alexeyev see this as the start of a new era. As he put it, the ball has started to roll, and the court system is no longer immune to gay emancipation.
Just a month after the execution of two gay teens caused an international outcry, persecution in Iran appears to be intensifying. According to the Persian Gays and Lesbians Organization, a massive internet entrapment campaign conducted by the Morality Police, Fundamentalist Militia, and the Revolutionary Guard has led to the arrest and torture of many gay men. One such victim, Amir, received 100 lashes before managing to escape to Turkey, where he hopes to be granted asylum by a gay-friendly country. The International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, expressed dismay that Iran's violations of international human rights agreements were not questioned at last week's gathering of world leaders at the United Nations. IGLHRC has issued an urgent recommendation for Iran to be called to account for its actions against gays and lesbians at the newly formed UN Human Rights Council.
If Amir the Iranian is looking for asylum in a gay-friendly country, Turkey is not the place for him. Chaos GL, the Gay and Lesbian Culture Research and Solidarity Organization, is being threatened with closure by the deputy governor of Ankara. After being in existence for nearly a decade, the leading Turkish LGBT group was approved for status as a non-governmental organization by the Ministry of the Interior, which passed the application on to its local Ankara branch. However, Deputy Governor Selahattin Ekremoglu cited two articles of the Turkish Civil Code which prohibit the establishment of any organization that is against the laws and morality rules. He initiated a court procedure to close down Chaos GL altogether. Homosexuality is not illegal in Turkey, and the Constitution provides for freedom of assembly. Activists are warning the government that the move could also jeopardize Turkey's accession negotiation with the European Union, which also specifies freedom of association in its Charter of Fundamental Rights.
The issue of same-gender marriage may be causing a breakup in Spain's main conservative opposition party. Popular Party Deputy Leader Ángel Acebes is spearheading the effort to draft a motion to have the 3-month-old marriage equality law struck down in constitutional court. Other party power brokers are not on board with the plan, however, fearing the appearance of homophobia will hurt them come election time. Socialist party leaders are seizing on the public split, pointing out that the Popular Party has opposed every attempt to advance the rights of lesbians and gays. Recent polls indicate that over half of the population supports same-gender marriage. 27 gay and lesbian couples have married in Spain since the law took effect on July 3rd.
In the U.S., the loudest marriage equality noise is coming out of California, where queer advocates have used petitions, email, phone calls, and letters to lobby Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to sign the first bill legalizing same-gender marriage to come directly out of a state legislature. Schwarzenegger has vowed to veto the bill, but as of September 23rd, the day the bill officially reached his desk, there's been no word of any action by the governor. Meanwhile, the state attorney general's office is moving ahead with its appeal of a recent court ruling that declared laws preventing same-gender marriage unconstitutional.
Schwarzenegger says he's standing by a ballot measure against same-gender marriage passed by California voters 5 years ago, but activists in Oregon are suing their state to have a similar initiative ruled unconstitutional. About 3,000 lesbian and gay couples received marriage licenses last year in Multnomah County, but they were nullified when the constitutional amendment was passed. Some of those couples are involved in the current suit, which argues that the measure was an improper and invalid exercise of the initiative power.
And finally, while others in the queer world are racing to the altar, one famous gay couple has called it quits. They've been an item for 6 years, raised an adopted child after desperately trying to conceive one on their own, and became role models of fidelity for their New York City community, until a home-wrecking female from San Diego came along. Silo and Roy, two male chinstrap penguins, have been among the stars at the Central Park Zoo since their relationship became public. But now Silo has moved in with Scrappy, and poor Roy reportedly sits alone staring at the wall, apparently trying to avoid watching his former love making penguins with a new, younger mate. Perhaps a personal ad would help, like BMW divorced male seeks monogamous bird. Destination, Canada?
That's NewsWrap for the week ending September 24th, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap was written this week by Lucia Chappell and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
And the play Ben has been with us for quite a while. Last year, there was a production at the Holocaust Museum of that play. I saw that. It was wonderful. They brought that back again this year for an even bigger and better production. The last two performances of that are October 1st and 2nd. That's Saturday and Sunday. You can get information of that by calling 713-522-2204. And I hope the following interview will interest you in attending that play. I interviewed Steve Bullitt, the lead actor. He plays Max in the play, and it's a short interview, but it should take you through the story. Here's Steve Bullitt.
Mike rannte fort von zu Haus und er suchte, wo Frieden ist.
This is J.D. We're here with Steve Bullitt, one of the lead actors of the new production of Bent. Steve, welcome to Queer Voices.
Thank you, J.D. It's good to talk to you again.
Tell me about this new production of Bent.
We did play this production a year ago here at the Holocaust Museum.
What time are we going to have left?
And the inspiration last year was related to an exhibit that involved the persecution of the homosexuals during the Holocaust. And because of the play's popularity, we decided to bring it back again. And we're very excited about it. The cast is seven members.
How will this production be different from the one last year?
We have a few cast changes, and that would be the primary difference. Also, one unique thing about the performance space, it's actually a lecture room, and it has a large screen. And last year we had certain slides that were displayed on the screen. This year we'll have slides that are related to a current exhibit here at the museum. An artist by the name of Saul Balagura has his art on display here at the museum, and the slides that will be shown on the screen will be sections of a particular piece of work that he has done. That piece of art is called Plowing Stones.
Is that an artwork related to the Holocaust?
Yes. Not particularly to the play, but to the Holocaust, yes.
Steve, I know I've seen you in a number of productions that admire your work. Can you tell our listeners about your acting background?
I've been acting for about 5 years.
A gay German song in the background. Thank you.
I started acting actually with Joe Watts, who is directing this production. I've done work all through town, and actually we'll be doing a production in December at Unity Theater in Brenham. I'll be doing their Christmas show, and I'm lined up to do a show at Theater Lab this coming spring.
What did you learn from being in this play?
It's a very difficult play to do. The play requires you to draw on an extremely deep emotional level, and it's very well written, and it's very rewarding, but it's also very difficult.
You find it draining to perform each show?
Yes, it is. The particular character I'm playing, Max, is in every scene, and there's a very wide range of emotions that are experienced during the course of 2 hours, and because of that, it is draining.
The original play was first staged over 25 years ago. Why do you think it's important for modern audiences to see?
The story is still relevant. We continue to this day to deal with persecution of groups of people because of their, obviously in this case, their sexual orientation, but because of their race. We see this in the Sudan and in other places in the world. And it's important for us to continually remind ourselves that this sort of persecution is unacceptable.
When and where can we see it?
The play will be at the Houston Holocaust Museum on September 15th, 19th, 20th, 27th, and 28th. The performance times are at 7:30. And those are primarily weekday nights because of events that they have at the museum on the weekend.
Are there any additional shows planned?
Yes. We're very excited. We're going to be one weekend at the Strand Theater in Galveston, and that'll be October 7th, 8th, and 9th. That's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The Friday, Saturday performances are at 8, and the Sunday matinee is at 2:30.
And this is a Theater New West production, and where can they call for reservations for this show?
For reservations, people can call 713-522-2204.
2204. And we were very fortunate last year that the shows were sold out, so I would recommend that people call early to make reservations.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, J.D.
And I've got one correction to that interview. That was recorded pre-Rita, and the last two performances are not this week. They've been moved to October 1st and 2nd, Saturday and Sunday. Saturday at 7:30, Sunday at 6 p.m. For information, 713-522-2204.
This is Queer Voices.
And organized labor than winning equal rights in the workplace. International trade union activists were among the contingent that joined with GLBT organizations to bring the issues of sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights meeting earlier this year in Geneva. Anna Biondi of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, or ICFTU, participated in a panel discussion entitled In Union, How Can Workers' Rights and the Struggle for Equality for Sexual Minorities Advance Together? Biondi says the work of the ICFTU, along with others like the ILO, the International Labor Organization, and PSI, Public Services International, can coordinate effectively with the efforts of lesbian gay groups, if only both sides stop to recognize their common goals.
For those of you who do not know the ICFTU, it's the largest, indeed, the trade union body, bringing together the national centers. It is more difficult, indeed, to work on these issues with the general national centers than with some specific global union federation that, indeed, have started such a good work like Education International and PSI. I think that if we play well with political and trade unions and other links, you know, you can make the issue of equal rights and non-discrimination, you know, I think that these issues can go through and people recognize the value of persons, and we are all different and we just all ask to be respected for what we are and to be included for what we are. Without saying that it's an easy way, but I certainly think that it's about time, and I think the role of the ICFTU, if you want, being an international confederation, what is our role? Certainly to follow the policy that comes out of our affiliates. You know, it doesn't mention that we have to create our own policy that doesn't reflect. But on the other hand, through a discussion, also to push our affiliates in going along with what we see as the vision. And indeed, the ICFTU Congress, which took place just last December, among the visions that were in the different resolution was this strong resolution on fighting discrimination and achieving equality. I suggest that you would go through the ICFTU website and you will see the different resolutions, and the resolution is quite open, and it starts immediately from the beginning about talking about discrimination based on sexual orientation. It pushes unions to work, and I think that this is a good platform for saying now it's about time also to act about to do a checklist of what unions are doing, and indeed what the national unions are not doing enough and not recognizing this as a problem. But I want to launch the ball back also to the movement, to the gay and lesbian movement. And I, just because I was talking before coming here to a brother that was coming from San Francisco, and he was telling me, look, in San Francisco it's very natural to have links with the gay and lesbian community on several issues, you know, it's normal. But he was saying, sometime I found the movement to be quite elitist. They are not very much interested in working on blue-collar issues, you know. So I think that as much as I'm ready to do my checklist of what the unions are not doing enough, I also want everybody to do the checklist and seeing, are you sure that you are also engaging enough with, you know, unions that are not, you know, white-collars union? You know, let's try to work together. Are you sure that are also you are engaging with certainly the double burden that would be for homosexual or gay and lesbian or transgender workers in a blue-collar situation. You know, certainly, I don't want to, you know, just to say, like, I don't want to take the responsibilities for labor movement, but I think that it's it has to be an open discussion about what we can do better together. I hope that also EI and PSI themselves will push the other global unions federation into coming into this debate, and we can do things together. We are working together. We will think about how to move to more action, because this is exactly what is coming out of our resolutions, where we say unions worldwide have to engage in activities and campaigns against discrimination. So, you know, it's like, let's build together the successful campaign, let's write together which are, you know, the best practices that we know. I certainly believe that the equal partnership rights should be one of the major issues around which, you know, I would imagine that we could come together. But this is something that we can do. I was, you know, for elected secretary of the workers group in the ILO. You know that the International Labour Organization is a tripartite body where you do have governments, but it's the only UN systems body where you have also workers and employers representative, and where we adopt labor standards, and certainly the reference to the Convention 111, that unfortunately sexual orientation is not listed among the reasoning for non-discrimination. And we have started this debate about also an update of Convention 111. The very difficult debate, I don't deny that, you know, we are moving. We are moving. I think that together with the ILO, we have certain activities now that we want also to push into the ILO on non-discrimination, on sexual orientation. We just adopted in February 2005, and I think it's the first time that the ILO has adopted a text on non-discrimination, sexual orientation. And it was the conclusions of the 7th European Regional Meeting in Budapest. We adopted for the first time a conclusion that have also paragraph 29 on equality and rights at work. And it was adopted on a tripartite basis that discrimination in access to employment and in occupation, whether based on gender, ethnic origin, political or religious belief, or other form of discrimination, including age, disability, and sexual orientations, remains a problem in the region. These are probably for you very, you know, watered down words. We were able to win this, and this is now an official ILO document. I please beg you to use it. You know, it's like, please go back and say that this has been adopted. Ask your own governments also to make sure that this is recognized. And I tell you, I want to use this in other regional meetings. It will be much more difficult. You know, it's like the next one is in Asia, and I'm not sure that they will go through. But, you know, it's a step. It's a small step. But as for any other instruments in the ILO or any other things, unless we use them, they remain words on paper. In the ILO, we do a lot of work around the core labor standards. The fight for freedom of association means also the fights for gay and lesbian workers to get together, to discuss their problems, and to use also the collective bargaining in order to make sure that these rights are recognized at the workplace. I think that this is a common goal. I think that we have a lot of work to do together, and I'm very pleased that the ICFTU is part of this discussion.
Anna Biondi of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions spoke at a panel during a meeting of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights earlier this year entitled In Union, How Can Workers' Rights and the Struggle for Equality for Sexual Minorities Advance Together? Her comments were recorded and edited by This Way Out correspondent Uma Kali Shakti, who also attended the meeting as the Pacific Regional Representative of the International Lesbian and Gay Association.
Hi, I'm B.D. Wong. I'm the actor from Law & Order Special Victims Unit and Oz, and the author of Following Through the Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. Oh yeah, I'm a gay guy.
politically progressive harmonies, energetic folk pop with a subtle sing-along, and provocative blues about everything from poverty to prostitution. That's the eclectic musical menu served up in this month's audiophile.
Faith believes in her closet. It's quiet, safe, and dry. It's hard to meet a lover there. She doesn't often try. The keeping of her secret steals the courage from her heart. Sure, Faith could move a mountain, but she's far too tired to start. Sure, Faith could move a mountain, but she's far too tired to start.
She Who is a women's vocal group based in Philadelphia, and their first recording is called The Earth Will Turn Over. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Audiophile. The group's founder, Karen Eskovitz, says that the album's focus comes from a decidedly progressive point of view.
It really places women at the center. Many of the pieces are political. It's very rare to find an album these days with explicitly pro-choice material on it. And then we have a number of songs that are kind of more peace-oriented. But I'd say that those are the characteristic themes of the album.
When a woman loves a woman, when a woman loves a woman,
find out more about the group She Who and their album The Earth Will Turn Over at www.shewho.org. That's www.shewho.org.
The third album by Julie Lloyd is called The Waiting Room, and in it she continues her blend of folk and energetic pop.
Julie to pick the most lyrically out song on the album.
I feel like the song on the album that's the most out is probably The Waiting Room, although I don't know if people would know it by listening to it. I like to think of it as sort of my lesbian anthem song. I don't know, it's kind of fun to play it in sort of totally straight audiences in like Nashville, Tennessee or whatever, and have them singing along to it, because it's a very like We Are thing, and they're all just singing along as if they know exactly what I'm talking about. And I don't think they know at all what I'm talking about, actually.
You can learn more about the album The Waiting Room by Julie Lloyd at www.julieloyd.com. That's www.julieloyd.com.
The seventh album by Candy Kane is called White Trash Girl. And once again, she proves her talent is as big as her voice.
She had the cutest Mona Lisa smile. I thought I had the time to try and make her mine. Something about her I just can't explain, like a face. faded dream, don't even know her name.
And like her previous releases, the album has a variety of styles, including boogie, gospel, jump swing, ballads, and of course, the blues.
For me, the blues is a really comfortable place to be because I can be a large-sized woman, I can be sexually provocative, I can sing songs about poverty and about prostitution and about my life, even my bisexuality, and it all works and comes together in the blues.
I'm a white trash girl from the wrong side of town.
Find out more about the album White Trash Girl by Candy Kane at www.candykane.com. That's www.candykane.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas, 77006. Or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trenton. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Cindy Friedman, Uma Kali Shakti, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Thanks also to John Frame. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Don't forget you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. For a few more days, your help to keep this program on the air will mean twice as much to us. So please log on to thiswayout.org for all the details. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KAOS Olympia, Washington, Radio Veronica, West Point, Pennsylvania, CJLY, Nelson, British Columbia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
And this is J.D. Last week, we were preempted by a speech by Louis Farrakhan. Well, leave it to me to bring you a song this week by Louis Farrakhan. And who knew it has a GLBT connection to it? Back in the early 50s, 53, 54, he was a calypso singer. He had a couple albums. One of the songs on it was called Is She Is or Is She Ain't? And that song was obviously inspired by the news about Christine Jorgensen. So how's that for a little queer music history?
I am trying to find a solution for a certain person. Trying to find a solution for a certain person with this modern surgery to change him from he to she. But behind that lipstick rouge and lip, I don't know if she is or if she ain't. Denmark. He tried to live the life of a man, but that was not in accord with nature's plan. So he underwent this operation and came back home to shock the nation. But behind that lipstick rouge and lip, I better know if she is or if she ain't.
of the public sentiment. She got movies on track and plenty engagement. People came out of curiosity to see this amazing freak of the century. But behind that lipstick rouge and face, I still wonder if she is or if she ain't. Of this modern age. Now she making plenty money because of hormones and plastic surgery. Joined at 20,000 a week, and not one listening to this record could get a peek. So behind that list, big rules and things, what do you think she is? Oh, yeah, I know she is.
In 1954, Louis Farrakhan going by the name as The Charmer.
Wow. Said, that's bad. That has to be one of the most unusual records on the history of the planet. Who would have thunk it?
Yes, and you found it. Mm-hmm. No less. You
leave it to J.D. to find those obscure queer music.
I love the obscure.
Well, sort of catch up, everybody, with what's going on. I mean, we weren't here last week.
But we're here, and we're queer now.
A number of things that went on, of course, the weather. I hope everybody is home and safe, and they have electricity. And things didn't go too badly. I know there was some damage. We were very, very lucky in the way the storm turned to be on the less hazardous side of the storm. And I'm sure a lot of people are decompressing who stayed in town and watched, you know, 72 hours of continuous coverage.
Yeah, that's all CNN had, that's for sure.
Right, and about 1 hour's worth of material. And you always know where Wayne Del Schifino goes in the worst part of the storm.
But I do enjoy looking at Anderson Cooper.
Yes, and I also like looking at Reggie Aki from Channel 11.
Oh, please. Well, you know, it behooves us to remember, whoever we like to look at, that this was a trial run. It could happen again. We're the memories of Katrina so fresh on our minds. You know, no one should feel bad because they tried to get out of town
or whatever
they did. I mean, much better to leave and come back and have everything safe and sound than to have not left and been in danger, or to leave and then come back and have things be really bad. So mm-hmm. we're very fortunate, yeah. and I hope everyone, you know, does remember whatever they didn't do this time that they should have, that they get prepared. And yeah.
I'm one of the evacuees. My partner and little dog and I left. We spent 14 hours on the road. We're not really sorry. We you make the decision with what information you have. You go with
I know a couple of folks that made it some places and ended up having a darn good time.
Well, and, you know, I certainly, you got to feel for the people who ran out of gas. I mean, they did prepare.
We saw lots of cars just sitting by the road.
So, and I think, you know, overall, I think Houston came out of it pretty good. They never really had that, to evacuate 2 million people, or how many people did try to evacuate.
Right. No one's ever done it before.
Right.
And once again, our city and county officials were on it. And
it was really interesting to me to see that the Democratic mayor and the Republican county judge were working together, it seemed like, very, you know, seamlessly. And as much as I'm not a fan of a lot of those elected officials, especially on the state level, they did seem to work pretty well together.
Right.
Well, they better after Katrina.
But, of course, I was very, very happy to have George Bush out there commanding this whole thing and saving
himself.
Know,
they kept saying reports like, oh, he's on his way to Texas. And making, like, oh, well, that's supposed to make us feel better or feel safer.
Yes,
you know,
making
I'm
the storm safe for Halliburton.
Exactly. So,
right. Well, and you know, I've certainly says that both he and the vice president do need to resign for their, how they handled the war and pretense to the war, and also how he handled Katrina. I mean, it was just...
Well, how that handled civil rights.
Well, and everything else, right.
Yeah,
right.
Talk about a disaster, a national disaster, is the person who resides in the White House.
And the cronyism has always gone on in politics, but he takes it to the next degree.
Boy, is it flying now.
Yes.
Yeah, and then to hear that Michael Brown, who resigned as the head of FEMA because of his mishandling, has now been hired by FEMA as a consultant to study the very problems that led up to...
Where did you hear that?
On the newscast this evening.
And then I had heard that he was still getting paid, you know, as the head of FEMA.
And there is a tropical depression... you know, that is going to bear watching. And I'm sure that a lot of people, the closer it gets to the Gulf, the more they're going to be watching it. And hopefully we won't have to go through, you know, anything more this hurricane season. But
well, and we're glad that, you know, all of the GLBT items survived. And it's, you know, unfortunate for the Women's Festival. Hopefully they'll reschedule it.
Yeah, they'll come back with it.
Yeah, they can check the website. Also, the Alley Theater had to do some readjusting for some plays that are in the works and some delays and changes in their schedule. Next week, Phil Mayard from the Alley is going to be on Queer Voices to talk about the Act Out series that they're having, which will open October 6th. With Be My Baby, which stars Hal Holbrook and Dixie Carter, and then current play Hapgood, they had to delay the premiere of it. So if you are interested in Alley Theater, you need to check out their website for the new changes there.
And we have an election coming up, and of course the amendment is on there. The you know, nononsensenovember.org is a place to check out their website and volunteer, because it's coming up very soon. And we do need to get organized.
Did you get the email I sent about the word marriage today?
Yes, but I didn't read it.
It's from yourdictionary.com. So if you log on to yourdictionary.com, their word of the day, marriage, and it's pretty interesting about the definition, the usage, and the... etymology of how the word came about, and it actually has to do with a young boy, which interesting in light. It even says in this that it with the same-sex marriage issue, how interesting that this is, what this word. So look it up.
Your internet.
Yeah, start your internet. Internet.
Well, and we would like to thank our guests this evening from the Sisters and their Decadent Dessert event that's happening this Sunday, October 2nd at Meteor from 4 to 7 p.m.
Right, and people can go to their website, which is www.assisthers.org, and use PayPal to buy tickets. Tickets will not be available at the door.
Oh, really?
Right.
It says here, oh, that's interesting. It says it is available at the door.
Oh, well.
Well, actually, it
let
is.
Me check there, that.
It's cheaper to buy it online than at the door.
Okay, $25 at the... I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say the price, but yes, it's more expensive at the door. There was something else that I was thinking of that is not at the door. God, there's so many things to keep up with. I can't keep up with it all.
Right, and then next week also we'll have David Elliott on, who's going to update us on current events in Washington. And it looks like Roberts will sell right through to get...
Was there any doubt?
This Friday, the Johnson Rayburn Dinner, which is a fundraiser for the Harris County Democratic Party. That's the thing, you can't get tickets at the door. You have to go to the website.
Okay.
See, it was in there somewhere, Jack. It just got muddled.
I understand. Well, we'd definitely like to thank you, that everybody who joined us this evening. We'll be back next week. And, of course, the next hour is Queer Music Heritage coming up.
With an in-depth look at women's music, featuring one of the publishers of women's music magazines and one of our favorite folk singers, Frank.
And also, if you had pledged in the last pledge-a-thon at KPFT, please do fulfill your pledges, because that money helps keep the station on the air. And luckily, we're still here. I know a lot of radio stations in New Orleans and in Beaumont went off the air, and those stations that don't have corporate backing will probably be a long time before they get back on the air, like WWOZ.
Okay. We used to go off the air even if there was one raindrop, so yay, KPFT.
Well, thank you. You're listening to KPFT Houston at 90.1 and 89.5 in Galveston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valinsky, Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, and Glenn Holt.
Hey, sing if you're close.
You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I started the show with a recording I just love, Frank's version of Surfer Girl. Frank is spelled P-H-R-A-N-C, and this year marks the 20th anniversary of her debut album called Folk Singer. She's recorded four other albums over the years, each filled with her own brand of humor and political commentary. I was delighted to get to see her perform in Houston last month and to interview her. You'll hear that interview and a lot more of her music, including two unreleased songs, in the second half of the show. But I'm starting off with another interview with someone I've admired for years. And this segment is unusual because her interview is among the very few that I've featured that is with someone who is not primarily known as a performer. But I think she's made many contributions to our GLBT society in general, and in particular, she's been an important force on the women's music scene for decades. Her name is Toni Armstrong Jr. Her activism has covered many areas, and in 1997, she was inducted into the Chicago Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame. I could go on for several minutes describing her talents and contributions over the years, but I want to focus on why I first became aware of her. My listeners no doubt know by now that I'm an avid collector of GLBT music, and I love exploring its history. And most of the time, researching that history is very difficult. Because ours is not a mainstream culture, the usual books and reference guides are not available. I've found that I have to rely heavily on newspapers and magazines that were issued during the early years of our music, and those are not readily available sources. So I was delighted when I discovered a publication called Hotwire. Its full name is Hotwire, the Journal of Women's Music and Culture, and was published from 1984 until 1994. To a researcher, this is a marvelous magazine. It expertly documented women's music during those years with its well-written, scholarly, and entertaining articles and numerous photographs. Information about the music of independent artists is hard to capture, so I was delighted to have such a resource. Toni Armstrong Jr. was the publisher of Hotwire, so I felt that she was in an ideal position to comment on the culture. So I interviewed her last June in Chicago when I was there for the Out Music Awards. And for background music, I've been using a song by one of the founding mothers of women's music, Margie Adam, from her Naked Keys album. Toni, you've been observing it, writing about it, and taking photos of it from its beginning. So you're in an ideal position to tell us, what is women's music?
If you line up 2,000 people and ask them what is women's music, you're going to get about 1,500 different answers. But the working definition that I've always used in my work is that it's woman-identified music. Possibly lesbian, possibly feminist, possibly something about your mother or your sister or your female coworker or the politics of women farmers. Never anti-feminist, never anti-gay, and never racist or oppressive in some way. Music by women, about women, and mostly for women.
Has that definition changed?
The definition of women's music, I don't think, has changed, but I think it has, with every passing six-month period since the 70s, grown to encompass something different. It started out very, very small, with a handful of artists that people could name, and with only a couple of different festivals, the National Women's Music Festival in 1974, the Michigan Women's Music Festival started in 75. There was actually another little one in 74 called a Woman's Sphere in D.C. that was started by the National Park Service, all over the place, but they were very small. With every explosive jump, something else was being Me too, me too, me too, include me. Include jazz, include classical, include hip-hop, include different races, include different class things, include women from other countries, on and on and on. And so every time there was something different going on, the definition perhaps altered itself a little bit.
So in the beginning, it was white women with guitars.
The false impression, and I think it's been perpetrated for some good reasons and for some bad reasons, is that women's music from its beginning was essentially white, a few white women with guitars, maybe a piano, probably from California, singing folk music. Why then does everybody think it's white women with guitars? Well, partially because the only people who could really afford to go on tour were women who were extremely portable in their act. So if you had an instrument that you could carry, you didn't need a huge sound system, you didn't need to buy airline tickets for six other people in your band, then you probably were going to get out on the road. Certainly class has a lot to do with it. Who had the money, who had visibility. You can't, you know, begin to tease out the racism from the whole thing. Of course, we live in a racist culture, so I think that feminists everywhere, and certainly women's music culture, has had its share of racism. There's no getting around that, but it also deserves a lot of credit for women, white women, thinking about privilege, thinking about anti-racism work, taking a lead in anti-racism work, and women of color being willing to step forward and take leadership and teach and be patient and make things happen collaboratively in a way that I don't see so much going on in most other parts of the world. And I think that women's music lyrics have at times really addressed racism issues from a very feminist perspective. A good example of that would be the song I Black Woman by Faith Nolan.
Faith Nolan's song, I Black Woman, came from her Freedom to Love album from 1989. What women's music artist was the first that you became aware of?
The first women's music artist I ever heard was Meg Christian, and I think that it's a Meg, Chris Holly, Kay Gardner, Alex Dobkin toss-up for many when you think of classic women's music. Although by 1980... we're looking at other women, certainly like Mary Watkins and Linda Tillery and Vicki Randall and a lot of other people in the mix. So for me personally, when I was still in college, somebody brought a Meg Christian album and said, oh, you have to listen to this song about the gym teacher. And that was that.
She was a big, tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female.
Of course, that was a little of Mae Christian's Ode to a Gym Teacher, one of the first classic lesbian songs. That came from Meg's debut album in 1974 called I Know You Know. What was your first involvement with publications about women's music?
My first involvement with publication that had to do with women's music was reading a magazine called Paid My Dues, which was started in 1974 in Milwaukee by a woman named Dorothy Dean, who, interestingly enough, went on to become the Milwaukee County Treasurer. And it was a journal of women and music, not really women's music because it didn't really exist yet. And it really focused on the role of women in music, different things like band leaders, whatever. So there were a group of women in Chicago in about 77 who wanted to take over publication. And I happened to be in on that conversation and said, oh, yeah, that sounds great. So between 77 and 80, I was involved with Paid My Dues.
Paid My Dues wasn't the first music women's publication.
Paid My Dues wasn't the first of the publications, but it certainly was the first to come out in a sort of a magazine journal format, covering what was soon to become called women's music, if we could say it that way. There were some other smaller newsletters around before, like Musica by Indy Allen, which came out of Oregon. There was a directory of women's media that was small, and in the mid-70s, there were different publications that were coming out around the country.
After Paid My Dues ended, there was a gap between when Hotwire started. Could you lead us up to the beginning of Hotwire?
Hotwire was a publication from, we started it in 1984, we stopped it in 1994. We put out 30 issues, came out three times a year, and it was devoted to covering women's music and culture. It had several major objectives. We wanted to print a lot of photos. We wanted to cover festivals. We wanted to have writers, like the feminist writers' input as well, not just in writing articles that are journalistic, but also talking about feminist writing, feminist theater, all of these things. Trying to pull together artists who would appreciate each other's work. For example, one of my favorite songs of all time from women's music is called Where Will You Be? It's a song by Nedra Johnson, who was very inspired by the work of Audre Lorde, Pat Parker, and other African-American feminist writers, and she wrote that song based on that.
How did you decide on the name Hotwire?
It comes from a poem written by Yvonne Zipter that's actually an erotic poem called Finding the Hotwire. So when younger women fantasize that, you know, the old crunchy granola dykes, which we're all dismissed as, are not sex positive, and I just laugh. It's like, oh, girls, you have no idea.
Your first cover story was on Kate Clinton.
Yes, our first cover was on Kate Clinton, and our very last cover was on Suzanne Westenhofer, and that felt very good bookends to do the comedians.
Tell us about the sound sheets. I think they were in a way revolutionary. It wasn't the first use of sound sheets in a magazine, of course, but to be used by a minority culture to get their culture out there was revolutionary.
I agree. I think that was one of the best ideas ever, was to put in these little flexi discs that we would literally, by hand, staple into the back of every magazine. And it was an opportunity. What we did was work with the artists and basically give it to them at cost. They could write it off as an advertising expense. Each magazine had a copy of anywhere between 4 and 6 songs by different artists, so they could not only read about these artists but also hear about the music. If they were in towns where they didn't have any kind of a feminist or a gay radio show, and most of our readers did not have that luxury, most of our readers were not anywhere near where a festival was held. Most of them did not have a bookstore in their town that carried, you know, feminist or lesbian music. This, in many ways, was their only way of hearing it. And of course, it is all about the music. The writing was great, but the reality is it's a live, performing, living thing. And if you can't hear it, it doesn't mean anything. So those were great. And over the 10 years that we published, and beyond, actually, that was one of the things we got the best feedback on.
How did Hotwire change or evolve over the years?
It evolved in several ways, big ways. Certainly, it got better looking with every single issue. By the time we got to the 30th issue, it was something that I feel anyone could be really proud of. It's a very professional-looking thing. In terms of content, it evolved along with women's music. By 1994, we not only had an extremely well-developed 20 years of women's music recordings, performances, festivals, publications, etc., radio shows, but we also had made a lot of major inroads into the mainstream entertainment industry. And that, in fact, is part of the reason Hotwire needed to stop. It wasn't possible to go on and have it be a quality publication and cover as much as we were having to cover. In the 10 years that we had been going, everybody else kept wanting to come to the party, so you had all the same old entertainers and things that you ever had, for the most part, but every single 6 months brought new entertainers and in different genres, and it got to the point where we simply could not cover everything from Ronnie Gilbert all the way down to the latest punk band all the way to the kinds of writing and zines that were happening and all the stuff that was going on, you know, on mainstream TV and you know, women like Melissa Etheridge and Katie Lang coming out and on and on and on. It became impossible without actually having a paid staff who could do nothing but focus on that. And rather than sacrifice the quality of what we had always done, we decided, really, it's time to stop. That the women's music era that magazine represented was coming to an end. It was a bitter pill to swallow, but I think we were realistic.
Please tell me about your own musical contributions to the movement.
My primary contributions to women's music have never been personal. They've been my ability to organize the bigger picture and provide, for example, a magazine or produce a concert. However, I did have my share of performing times. It's been pretty fun. I was in a band in the early 70s, mid-70s, called Starkist, which was a lesbian punk band. And that was pretty different for those times. In looking back, there weren't hardly any bands like that. We just played in Chicago. I was in another band called Surrender Dorothy, which went for 3 or 4 years here in Chicago as well. And it was really pretty popular in its day. We performed mostly music that was written by Paula Wolowitz. Several of her songs have gone on to more prominence elsewhere. And I was in a little group called the Dental Damsels for a while. Most of the stuff that I was involved with never got recorded. I think that there's a pretty lo-fi version of a song on the High Risk CD done with Paula Wolowitz. Goddess's Rage, or Neo-Paganomics, we called it, that has become kind of popular in the Wiccan circles. And there was also a song, one of my favorites, called Surprise, that was recorded on Gay and Straight Together, on Jenny Clemons' Open Door label. That song, in fact, was written by Paula at a time when I had already started working at this high school where I still work, and it was just so painful to not be able to come out at work. And part of her song is, I'm looking forward to the day when I can say, surprise, I'm gay, and the people at work will smile and say, that's great. Where are we going to lunch today? And it was such a dream back then that it could ever be like that. And just recently, I went to Canada and got married so that I could be legally married. And 50 of my colleagues at the high school where I work got together and gave me a wedding shower at school in the principal's conference room. And it's mind-boggling to play that song now and remember that exact same job back then, and how, wow, everything has just changed so much, more than the mind can even embrace.
Are you married? Well, no. Then you're single. Suppose so. At least that's what it's called. I understand. I'll bet, wink, wink, that you're living with your boyfriend. Well, I got an open mind. Well, no. In fact, my roommate is a very good woman friend of mine. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, and goodness, here I am again, dodging all the questions while staying on my toes. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, explaining why there is no man in my life. I'm a loner, I suppose. When actually I've been living my life with the person of my dreams, and though I should keep it under my hat, there are times when I want to scream. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, and goodness, here I am again, dodging all the questions while staying on my toes. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, explaining why there is no man in my life. I'm a loner, I suppose. I'm looking forward to the day when I can say, surprise, I'm gay, and the people at work will smile and say, that's nice. Where are we going to lunch today? Surprise, I'm a lesbian, being only as I am, as I've chosen to be. A woman loving woman standing
up against the lies and sharing her delightful surprise. Oh, I'm looking forward to the day when I can say, surprise, I'm gay, and the people at work will smile and say, that's great, let's go out and celebrate. Surprise, I'm a lesbian, being only as I am, being as I've chosen to be. A woman loving woman standing up against the lies and sharing her delightful surprise.
Do you have any last words for my listeners?
Something that really interests me as both as a historian and somebody who lived through the history that's being talked about or written about is what gets emphasized and what doesn't. And sometimes people really do miss the forest for the trees. Sue Fink, an artist that I really have always appreciated, once was talking about women's music isn't the music. It isn't a form of music. Women's music is an audience. I think that that is exactly right. No, we didn't exactly produce Melissa Etheridge, although she did, in fact, play at early women's music festivals. No, we didn't produce Tracy Chapman, but I have photos of her at Michigan and National. You know, we didn't produce the stars. However, we produced the audience that was there for the stars when they were ready to step up and come out. We produced way more than a taste for out gay music or out feminist music. Every time women went to a women's music festival, they were changed by the politics. They went home and they were less likely to accept racism or sexism on the job. They were more likely to say, how come we don't have a sign language interpreter here? They were more likely to think about what's going on in their community and how they could be better and different. And it just has permeated hundreds and thousands of lives and made changes all across the board. And so you're beginning to see interesting things now as this sort of young generation turns into older women. One of the fun things that I've been involved in lately is everybody's looking around at the Red Hat Society, and my basically 80-year-old lesbian mom in California belongs to a Red Hat Society chapter, and she was having so much fun. And I thought, oh, that's something that I could do here in Chicago. You have to be 50. It's to celebrate women that are over 50, the accomplishments and wonderfulness of women over 50. And I thought, well, that fits right in with my whole lesbian feminist life. So I started here in Chicago the first openly lesbian Red Hat chapter called the Amazon Lesbian Red Hat Sisterhood. I wanted to make sure it was as clear as possible what we were. And our theme song is Lynn Lavner's I Like Older Women.
Keep all your cuties untested and tried. Build them a playground and lock them inside. I've a yen for the female whose war has been waged like a steak has been properly seasoned and aged. I don't care for the chippies at all. I want their mothers to call. Oh, I like older women. I like the grown-up kind. Give me a stable adult, not the teens in their jeans. And what's a Madonna? Youth is a pain in the ass. I like my Coke in a glass. Oh, I like older women, and I hope that they like me too.
That was Lynn Lavner and her song Older Women. You can hear a whole interview with her on my show from March of 2003.
Hi, this is Holly Neer.
Hi,
this is Chris Williamson.
This is Margie Adam.
And you are listening to Queer Music Heritage on KBFT, Houston.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website at www.queermusicheritage.com. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. And both of the women featured on tonight's show gave me wonderful interviews, so good that I cannot possibly fit it all into an hour show. So you can hear an expanded version of the show at my website, with a lot more songs and comments. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper, now in its new time every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude.
was a bit of the Hermit's Hermit song, Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, as covered by Frank in 1995, another of my favorites by her. And you'll want to stick around because this segment will include two songs by her that have not been released yet, one of which she sang to me during our interview. Frank was in Houston last month because she'd been on tour with a group called The Knitters. So let's get to the interview. How did you get started in music?
Well, I listened to music from the time I was really small. Both of my grandfathers played the violin and the guitar, and I grew up with great records in the house, Broadway show tunes, Alan Sherman, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Peter, Paul and Mary, Judy Garland. So I listened to lots of records growing up.
And how did you get the name Frank?
Well, I changed my name at the Lesbian History Exploration in May of 1975. And I named myself Frank, F-R-A-N-C, when I was up there at that lesbian retreat. At that retreat, I met Alex Dobkin and, a number of Elsa Gidlow, incredible lesbians, and Eliza Cowan, who showed had a fashion show, and she showed a slideshow called What the Well-Dressed Dyke Will Wear. And there I saw these dykes resplendent in three-piece suits and buzzed hair, and I was so moved. I changed my name already, and when I came home from that expedition, I got on the bus and I went straight to the barbershop, and I had all of my hair buzzed off, and I went to show my friend Pumpkin my new haircut and tell her my new name, and I showed up at her door, and she opened the door and she said, "Wow." And I said, "My name is Frank." And she went, "Frank." She says, "Just stay right there." And she went in the other room, and she came back with a blue baseball hat with a P on it. And she put it on my head, and she said, "Frank, P, P-H, P-H-R-A-N-C. So that's how I got my P-H. So.
And the title that seems to be all yours is All-American Jewish Lesbian Folk Singer.
Yes, that is the moniker that I have given myself, the All-American, the basic average All-American Jewish Lesbian Folk Singer.
And your first band was Nervous Gender?
That's the first band I was in. I've been playing since I was 14, doing shows, but probably from when I was 17, I played mainly like lesbian coffee houses. There were just a few of those. And then when I was 19, I was in Nervous Gender, which was a synthesizer band in Los Angeles, part of the very avant-garde, screamer-ish kind of scene that was attached to the local Los Angeles punk rock scene.
Did you record anything with them?
No, I didn't. They recorded, but I never recorded with them. So there's a number of Nervous Gender things out, but I don't think there's anything with me singing on it. I don't think.
And then to Catholic Discipline.
Catholic Discipline and Nervous Gender and Castration Squad, everything kind of overlapped all around the same time. I was in Nervous Gender, and then I got asked to be in Catholic Discipline. And there's a new actual Catholic Discipline recording out on Artifix Records, which is pretty good. I mean, it's pretty true to what it was really like.
What prompted your switch from punk to folk?
I mean, technically it was a switch, but inside me, I've always been a folk singer. So, but to go back to playing acoustically, the motivation behind it is directly related to the song Take Off Your Swastika. And I wrote that as a reaction to basically the fashion that was going on during the punk scene at the time, which was people were wearing swastikas. I'm Jewish. It made me angry. I wrote the song Take Off Your Swastika. And since I wrote that song, I wanted people to be able to hear the words. And so that was why I started playing acoustic again. And the great thing was that the audience didn't change. I still played to all the same people that I played to in the bands. It was all the punk audiences. It was all the same clubs. I was still playing with all of the same bands. But I was playing acoustic, so you could hear the words. And that was the start of my solo career.
Let's hear a little of Take Off Your Swastika.
like a swastika. It really nauseates me. You say pray, it's just a symbol. It's just an emblem. It's just a righteous decoration. Fascism isn't anarchy. Fascism isn't anarchy. Fascism is not anarchy.
That was Take Off Your Swastika, an early song by her, though it did not appear on record until her 1989 release called I Enjoy Being a Girl. How did you land the record deal with Rhino Records?
I made my first record, Folk Singer, and it's the 20th anniversary of that record. And so I pressed some records just for this tour, some CDs, I should say. But it came out as a record on vinyl. And I'd saved my money from teaching swimming. I saved $1,200 from teaching swimming and lifeguarding in Santa Monica. And I didn't know anything about making records. I knew the kind of record I wanted to make. I knew I wanted to make a solo acoustic record. I knew I wanted it to be, like, very true and very simple and plain. And my friend Craig Lee from The Bag said, we're going to go in and make your record. I know right where for you to go. And he took me to see Ethan James at a little studio in Venice, California called Radio Tokyo Studios. And I went in there with my handful of songs. And Folk Singer is what came out of that. And I recorded that for $1,200. And when I was finished with it, Gary Stewart from Rhino Records said, we'll put it out. And so I was very fortunate in that somebody was interested and put that record out right away. But people often say, you know, what should I do to make a record? How can I get my record out? And my attitude has always been, you know, don't wait around for somebody else to do it for you. If I had waited around for somebody to want to make my record, I don't know if I'd ever have made a record.
I want to go through your albums. Folk Singer was the first and came out in 1985. From it, please tell me about the song Amazons.
Amazons is my tribute to all of the great women in sports, and at that time, it really is a historical document now, because a lot of the athletes that I'm singing about, the song is 20 years old, if not 25, and so they were at their peak then. Cheryl Miller was a wonderful basketball player, Annie Myers, Tammy Kennard, the great badminton player. Diana Nyad is now a sportscaster on NPR. You hear her all the time. But she was best known then for her great prowess at long-distance swimming. And she is one of my great heroines. So many of the women that I acknowledge in that song were great inspirations to me.
Oh, give me a pair of pectorals like Diana Nyad. I want to swim 89 miles. Give me a set of deltoids like Tracy Clawkins. I wanna be strong like those Amazons. I wanna learn to dribble like Annie Myers. I wanna learn to shoot like Cheryl Miller. I wanted to play for the Dallas Diamonds and live with Martina like Nancy Lieberman. Strong, strong. Strong, strong, like an Amazon.
Tell me about Life Lover.
Life Lover is a song that I wrote a very long time ago. It was one of the very first songs that I wrote around the time of Take Off Your Swastika. I wrote the song in a suicidal state. I wrote the song because I was so depressed that I wanted to die. And I thought, if I write this song and I kill myself, I'll look really stupid. It was a self-preservation that I wrote that song out of. And I tell you, it has completely turned around and become my anthem. And but that's where that song came from. It came from a very dark place, and my life has become very bright because of it.
Recently, friends have been departing permanently, but not me. I plan to stick around, you see, 'cause I'm a life lover, that's me. Yes, recently, friends have been departing permanently. 'cause I'm a life lover, that's me. Now all my parts work, my eyes and my nose, my hands, my fingers, my legs and my toes, and that makes me love life. Oh yes it does. I'm not gonna go away, I'm here to stay, because recently friends have been disappearing mysteriously, but not me. I plan to stick around, you see, 'cause I'm a life lover, that's me.
We're up to 1989 and your second album. Tell us about the song Martina.
Oh, Martina, of course, is my great tribute to Martina Navratilova, perhaps the greatest woman athlete of all time.
Oh, I got up at 7 just to watch her win. Playing on the worn grass courts at Wimbledon. If anyone should ask me who's the greatest, well, I would have to say, without a doubt, in my mind, it's M-A-R-T-I-N-A. 'Cause M-A-R-T-I-N-A, she's the greatest in the world today. N-A-V-R-A-T-I-L-O-V-A, she's the greatest in the world today. Now Steffi, she's worked hard and she's earned my respect, but when it comes to the game of tennis, it's Martina who's the best, 'cause M-A-R-T-I-N-A, N-A-V-R-A-T-I-L-O-V-A, she's the greatest in the world of women's tennis, that's.
Looking over your catalog, which song of yours gets the most audience reaction?
Reaction, I would say, probably the most current and the most topical song. Like, I'll Play Tonight, you'll watch. You'll see Condoleezza will probably get the biggest reaction. But political songs get a great reaction. Take Off Your Swastika still gets a very powerful reaction. Life Lover always gets a great reaction. And I end all my shows with Life Lover. But you'll watch the Condoleezza song tonight. It'll probably get a lot of attention. Whatever's the most topical song usually gets the biggest reaction at the time, and then it's always nice when people have favorites. So we'll see what's the big hit tonight.
And here's the song she was talking about, and it is very topical, called Condoleezza.
Condoleezza, Condoleezza, Condoleezza.
the truth. Musical, come on. You could change your tune. I'm not mighty like Chevron. I'm just a Jewish lesbian. And Condi, I can't name a tanker after you. So tell me what I have to do. Should I translate it into Russian for you, Condoleezza? Bring home the troops.
And that was a Queer Music Heritage exclusive. Hashish not recorded that song yet and sang it for me during our interview. We're talking about the Positively Frank album, and on it, the group Two Nice Girls helped you out.
Yes, Two Nice Girls. That was a lot of fun. We recorded that at Willie Nelson's old studio. We had a blast. Warren Brule came out and produced it. And I came to Austin and we recorded, I don't know how many songs we did together. 3 or 4 songs on that record. Yeah, we had a great time. We had a great time.
Around this time, you did a Neil Diamond impersonation act called Hot August Frank.
Hot August Frank. Well, what happened in 1991 was Positively Frank came out. It started to gain some momentum. Everybody was really excited about it. As far as the label was concerned, you know, it was the most radio accessible record I'd ever made. And I was on this huge tour. I got Morrissey called me to come and open his tour, which was a world tour. We started in England. We did the States. We were going to go on and do Japan and Australia. It was a very exciting time, and what happened was we got to the point we got to Boston, and I was doing a live radio show in Boston, and on the air in Boston, technician at the studio came in and said that I had gotten a phone call, and so I went in the other room to take the phone call, and it was my father telling me that my brother had been murdered. And that was kind of it for me. I went home and I disappeared for a long time. It was just the end of the tour for me. And that was July 2nd, 1991. And the tour had started in April. So I was away for a couple months. And then July 2nd, I went home. And in September, October, the label dropped me, and that was kind of the end of my career for a little while there. And I didn't really want to sing. Morrissey asked me to come back on the tour, and I tried. I went and did a date in England, and it really wasn't any good for me. I couldn't be in front of people. So I went home and I made art, and it was one of the things that I could do. And if you go to my website, you can see, you can click on Cardboard Cobbler. And I started making visual art again, because it was something I could do and be creative without people watching me, and it made me happy. And so that was the start of me doing illustration and returning, because I'd always done visual art, but really kind of focusing on that again. And then I needed a way to get back on stage. So the question you asked me was about Neil Diamond, and what happened was, years before, I had done a workshop at a folk festival, the Mariposa Folk Festival in Canada. And Jean Sibbery was part of that panel, and the title of the workshop was The Worst Song I Ever Learned. Now, when I was a kid, the worst song that I ever learned was Solitary Man, and I hated that song. And so I did the song in that workshop, and I talked about it. And I had been talking to somebody about it during the time where I was making my art, and I described that, and they said, oh, you should do Neil Diamond. I mean, like, you should sing Neil Diamond. And I was like, yeah, right. And then I thought, that would be a really fun way to get back on stage, to not be me, to be somebody else. And so that's where Hot August Frank came from. And I think I was with Holly Hughes at the time, and she's the one who said, Hot August Frank. And I went, yeah. And so the rest is kind of history, because it got things rolling for me again. You know, I put my chest hair on and I got back on stage. And was a tremendous success. It was a lot of fun. I put a band together. The band was terrific. And so that was a real turning point for me. It really got me on stage. It really helped me. And after that, I was kind of back on my feet again, and I had songs that I wanted to make and that I wanted to do, and I always wanted to do Ode to Billy Joe, and I started writing songs again. I had been surfing every day since my brother died. I wrote Surfer Dyke Pal, and I wrote Bull Dagger Swagger. You know, a lot of stuff happened, and I had Frank opening for Hot August Frank. So Frank was the opening act, and then, you know, she would talk about how great Hot August Frank was, and then she would leave the stage, and then Hot August Frank would come back with the band. So it was really great on a lot of levels.
Team Dresch, or at least Donna Dresch, helps you out on the Goofy Foot album.
Team Dresch changed my life. Team Dresch, I was invited to play a show in San Francisco at the San Francisco Women's Building, and it was put together by Q-Tip, Queers Together in Punkness. And it was a very cool kind of do-it-yourself show put on by this little queer punk community. It was me, Team Dresch, Bucktooth Varmints, and Cheesecake. And I had never seen Team Dresch before. I had only heard of them. And when I saw them play, I hadn't been that moved for many, many years. I stood in that audience just completely inspired, crying because I was so excited, and I had such a strong identification with them and loved them so much. And we made friends that night, and we're still friends today. I talked to Jody from the road, and she just had a kid, and I talked to Donna. I stay in touch with everybody from the band.
They did a song for you called Uncle Frank.
They did Uncle Frank, which was, wow, you know, I'm still very touched by that.
What do you think your contribution has been to queer music?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what my contribution to queer music is. Hopefully I have a contribution that's bigger than just to queer music. But the point of me being on stage and coming out as a lesbian and being so vocal about being a lesbian on stage, and I still feel very strongly about that, is people say to me from time to time, oh, come on, Frank, you know, do you still have to say it? Everybody knows you're a dyke. Everybody knows you're a lesbian. And, hey, it's no big deal anymore. Well, you know, I personally feel that it is a very big deal. It's still a big deal because people are still killing themselves because they're gay and lesbian, and they feel like they're the only ones in the world. And it might be hard for some people to believe in the world where I think part of society thinks that there's a lot of gay liberation, and there are a lot of gays and lesbians that are out in entertainment. Well, the truth is there's just a handful, if that. And that doesn't really help when you're 13, 14, 16, 17, coming out and feeling like you're the only one in the world, or knowing that somebody is out there, but you can't get to them and you can't connect. And I feel that if I stand on stage and I come out, I don't know who's going to see me. I don't know who I'm going to reach, but hopefully, I can give some hope to someone out there so that they can grow up and be exactly who they are, whether they're straight, whether they're queer, whether they're trans, whether they're dykes. Everybody should have the opportunity to grow up and be who they are. If there's any message, that's the one that I'd like to spread.
Tell me about the Tupperware lady.
Oh, the Tupperware lady. Well, I did sell Tupperware. In fact, I still have my toe in the plastic. In 1999, when we had our first daughter, I did not want to go on tour. I did not want to leave the house. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to leave my family, my new family. And so I had to figure out a way where I could stay home, make my records, and make money. And it was kind of a joke. I said to Lisa, I said, I could sell Tupperware. And she said, yeah, right, you're going to sell Tupperware. And I said, no, I love Tupperware. I'm going to sell Tupperware. And I opened the phone book and I called Tupperware, where the rest has become history. Because what came out of that was, not only did I find a new women's community, not only did I love Tupperware, love the women, learn a lot, and I started selling like gangbusters, so I became very, very, very successful at Tupperware, climbed the ranks in the Tupperware world, and actually, there was a documentary made about my first year selling Tupperware that's called Lifetime Guarantee, Frank's Adventures in Plastic, which was greatly received at festivals all around the world and is still awaiting distribution. Hopefully that's going to happen soon. But I had a lot of fun and made a lot of money. And it was because I needed to find an alternative way to make money and still do all the stuff that I love. So it enabled me to stay home, still make my records, still write my songs, be with my kids, do the Tupperware parties at night. And Tupperware is still fantastic. I mean, and it's very empowering for women. And it's a really, really great experience.
Oh, yeah.
Thank Frank for providing me with the unreleased song, Tupperware Lady. What is ahead for you musically?
I hope to have a new record out by hopefully the holidays, but I should be out touring again in the spring. That's my goal, to be out touring again in the spring. Mark my words. Might not be a really long tour, but I'll be out with something new, record this Condoleezza song, and have a whole new record full of new material. And if you go to my website, folksinger.com with a PH, you will be able to find out all my tour dates, when my new record's coming out, buy Tupperware, look at my artwork, maybe buy my artwork, and hopefully be able to download songs soon. So I'm working on that. And we still have, I think, 5 or 6 dates left on this tour. So this tour has been really, really great. I really want to thank, on the air, I'd really like to thank Exene Cervenka of X and the Knitters for inviting me on this tour, because it's really just inspired me and reminded me that this is what I still do, you know? I'm still the all-American Jewish lesbian folk singer. I still sing songs that hopefully make a difference, and I still have a lot of fun.
Now I've got one more song to share with you. But before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening and to thank Tony Armstrong Jr. and Frank for the wonderful interviews. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com, and I wish you would. My website, of course, is at www.queermusicheritage.com and also at www.queermusicheritage.org. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I usually save my favorite song by an artist and use it to close the show, and that's what I did with Frank's song, Bull Dagger Swagger. In 1995, a 5-song EP came out called Goofy Foot, and it contained my favorite song of yours, Bull Dagger Swagger.
I'm trying to think of how I wrote Bull Dagger Swagger. I know I originally wrote it on the ukulele. It's very danceable. It's very self-affirming. It's funny. It's dykey. It's one of my favorites, too, I think. Really do.
To every young man who can't pass, from every lipstick, lazy lass, from every drag queen's high heels.
Here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Networks station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. And don't forget to volunteer for Q Patrol, a nonprofit corporation running citizens' watch patrols in the Montrose to prevent hate crimes. It's fun, safe, and easy to do. Just call 713-528-SAFE. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.